Welcome to Real Geeks. I am Crash and Burn, and with me as always is Mike Montgomery.
And yeah, okay, sometimes I regret my life choices.
Oh yeah! Tonight, for a very special presentation, one time only, one night, one fight, one piece of shit! This is 1989's No Holds Barred!
Hey! Are you looking for a little escape? Wanna see something?
This is sick!
You don't see every day. Are you ready for a whole new Hulk Hogan? Rip, Hulk Hogan is ripped. To the world, he's a hero. But to this man, he's history. Zeus. Stand back. Way back. Get ready for the battle no ropes can hold. No ring. No referee. No rules.
Gentlemen, it's time.
No holds barred.
This is an unprecedented display of strength and determination.
I selected this movie for the, you know, films that have influenced my past and before, because it's like, I love wrestling. I love bad, just insane movies. This should have worked.
You know, and the thing is, okay, so no, I'm going to come at this from a slightly different angle, because I do think it does work, but not as what it's meant to be. And there's a lot of, like, when I say it does work, I'm like saying, this is the worst piece of pizza I've ever had. But, you know, there's something about the crust that I kind of like. So for context, just for context, because it's going to sound like you don't like this movie and I do like this movie. And what we're talking are more shades of no, it's crap. But like, I think I found something in it that at least elevates it a tiny bit, just a tiny bit. But we'll get into that later.
Oh, yeah. And like, to be very clear, I'm not specifically saying I don't like the movie. What I am saying is, if you are coming into this looking for the cocaine-fueled insanity that was 80s wrestling, the trailer you just heard was everything you need. Because that's all that they put in the trailer. The rest of this movie is so bland that the white powder that you were getting is not cocaine. It's flour.
This movie is very straightforward. It's kind of amazing that it stars Hulk Hogan and Tiny Lister and was produced by the WWF and like includes moments set in the WWF with Jesse Ventura and like the ref. I can't remember the ref's name. Why? Mean Gene is there, and like, you know, it's classic late 80s WWF. It's a beautiful thing. And it's like the plot itself, the elements, the action, all of it feels like it's from a much cheaper, not involved with the WWF, with a mainline production film about wrestling. My God, is it a decent like film about full-on kayfabe wrestling? Yes. For that is very good. But it's like watching old school wrestling. It's like watching an old NWA or Jim Crockett or whatever fucking production, where it's like, it's just two burly dudes who grunt at each other. There's none of the spectacle, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's the most straightforward. Here's what traditional pro wrestling wants you to think is happening, without any of the ridiculousness to get in the way and scare people off and confuse them and make them think that this is that Saturday morning cartoon show all over again.
I'm just going to read the plot summary that IMDb has, because I feel like this will just say so much in and of itself.
Before you do that, I want to infect the audience with a perspective, because I went into this intentionally viewing it as a side sequel to Rocky III. This is what Thunderlips is doing now. This occurs in the Rockyverse. Creed happens in this same universe, and essentially, in many ways, is also the plot for Creed. Creed's better. Creed 3, I mean. Watch Creed 3. Watch Creed 2. Watch Creed.
Yeah.
Hey, this whole ridiculous series of films okay, so why am I talking about Rocky 3? I mean, aside from the obvious fact that Hulk Hogan was in it as Thunderlips, and this is 1982, before he was like big, Rocky 3 put him on the national spotlight, even for just a minute. Like primed the audience for him. Hogan had been working for the WWF at the time. That was Worldwide Wrestling Federation, owned by Vince McMahon. No, not that one. His father,
The one with ethics.
Yeah, exactly. By all accounts, an ethical, sensible, territory loyal,
yeah,
wrestling promoter. His son, on the other hand, was different. We'll get into that.
Oh boy!
Oh yeah. Hogan pissed Vince Senior off by leaving the promotion to go film the spot in Rocky III, because first of all, it broke Hogan's kayfabe, because he wasn't playing his character in the movie. Yeah. And so that was fucking verboten. You don't break kayfabe, and you definitely don't do it on a national spotlight. Oh my God. Listen, Jerry Lawler beat the fucking shit out of Andy Kaufman on national television repeatedly. They said the word fuck and motherfucker on live television in the 1970s, incurred enormous amounts of heat, and oh my God, I think David Letterman got like a bunch of fees from the FCC for that.
Oh, no doubt.
Because they were committed 100% to the bit. And that was the standard at the time. You committed to the bit. And if you had the biggest goddamn audience in the world, you committed hard. Anyway, Hogan's always committed to himself.
Yeah, and also, just to add to that, remember, we are talking about the same Hulk Hogan who once accidentally choked out Richard Belzer on his own talk show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just to prove that wrestling was not fake.
Yeah. There's a whole wonderful history that can be found on YouTube of wrestlers doing things to reporters and TV hosts who will tell them to their face, oh, well, wrestling's fake.
Or particularly if you have seen Dark Side of the Ring, I have two words for you. John Stossel.
John Stossel. That's a good one. That's a good one. Also, watch Dark Side of the Ring. It's amazing.
Absolutely.
Anyway, so Hogan got fired. Hogan got fired, and Hogan went off and did a couple of other performances, I believe, down south. And in that meantime, Vince Jr. appeared, and he ate his father's heart and soul, and then took the company and made it his, and he swore a pact with Satan himself to become king of the world. King of the world! And
now I know that you were all thinking that Crash is exaggerating for comedic effect. As someone who has been a wrestling fan since about 2 years before this film came out, she is not. I want to be very clear. She is not.
Vince McMahon is the biggest asshole on earth. And that's saying something, because his best friend is Donald Trump. Anyway, and Vince's main ploy for doing this is to approach pro wrestling as if it is a fucking comic book. We go out there. We big personalities, big beefy bodies. The beefier, the better. And this is Vince.
Well, that is 100% Vince to this day.
Vince McMahon is a man who once founded a bodybuilding contest that failed spectacularly because, like, most guys don't want to watch dudes in thongs flexing. Like, it's one thing to have the melodrama and the action of wrestling. This was skipping right to the end point of Vince's non-sexual fetish for muscly men, and no one else wanted to follow. Anyway, that's a different adventure.
Oh,
that's another waste of his millions. It's amazing that this man is as rich as he is.
That was the McMahon biopic that he made damn sure it doesn't get made.
Big Beefface.
And I'm not kidding. Look it up.
Okay. And the biggest cartoon out there at the time was Terry Hulk Hogan. I believe his last name is pronounced Bolera, is it?
I think it's Bolia.
Bolia. Now, Terry's a bullshit artist. Terry's the world's biggest bullshit artist. But what he's really good at, aside from stealing the superstar's character, is amping people up about himself. He's really good at, like, generating charisma around himself, which is good because, as I said, he's a bit of an asshole in every other context of his life.
Oh, yeah.
That includes professionally, because Terry makes decisions for Terry's sake, and Terry went and made a movie. Terry doesn't give a fuck about your kayfabe. Yo, you fired Terry? Terry's going to your competition. Oh, your evil bastard son took over the company? Terry will take a ton of money. Thank you to come back.
Not only did Terry go and make a movie, I would like to take this opportunity to read the very first piece of trivia on IMDb for No Holds Barred.
Mm-hmm.
The movie was produced by star Hulk Hogan and his boss, World Wrestling Federation head honcho Vince McMahon, only to be distributed by New Line Cinema after completion. When the first draft of the script was turned in, Hogan and McMahon disapproved of it, so they checked into a hotel in Redington Beach, Florida, and stayed up for 72 hours rewriting the script together. Which, you've got to admit, explains so much.
It gets a little more detailed. I found a Medium post by author Kevin Cecil. Now, again, this is just a post adding on to it. But he claimed that in Hogan's biography, Hogan gives further information about this night. Now, for context, this is deep into the steroid and cocaine years for both of these gentlemen. and like, they're feeling invincible at this point. And they're in the early years of WrestleMania, so, like, anything can happen. But there's another important thing that is occurring that we'll get into, but at this exact moment, that hasn't fully formed yet. We'll get into it, because it's important. But apparently, they were stuck. It's near the end of it. They're stuck. They can't figure out the final bit of the movie. What is the final fight? What is it? My God. And Terry goes to the bathroom and starts to take a shit. And it comes to him in a vision. The entire final fight, the climax of this movie, while he is taking a cocaine-fueled shit. And, you know... That makes sense.
Yeah, it really does.
that's alleged, or at least that's secondhand hearsay. But you know that I have heard Toomey's stories about Terry and shit. Like Toomey's stories involving Terry and shit, and they all seem to come from him ultimately. So I'm just gonna believe it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this movie has an ending that just refuses to stop.
Yeah.
So I feel like the logic is sound here.
Yeah, it feels like a wrestling match because it's literally just a wrestling match. It's a Hogan squash match. That's it. You know, there's a little bit of back and forth, but then he gets the mania and off he goes. He came back. They due to the popularity of his appearance in Rocky III, they were able to get a little bit of attention from Hollywood, and that led to Cyndi Lauper coming up with a business agreement with them, based entirely on fandom, mostly of Lou Albano, if I recall. I think it was she met Lou Albano on an airplane ride, and she was like, "Oh my god, I love wrestling. I love everything that you guys do. I saw Rocky III; it was fantastic." And that spiraled into the Rockin' Wrestling, if I recall, on
MTV.
That's
the one. Yep.
And then that led to the ability to get enough backing for the first WrestleMania. And so we're spiraling into the WWF's like golden age, where they essentially turned pay-per-view into a national spectacle that was not just like, oh, watch some wrestlers. It was a fucking entertainment, like fucking show. Like there's no way to explain the chaos that is the first WrestleMania, because like there's too many musical acts and random fucking celebrities just appearing, and you're like, what in the shit is this? And then wrestling. Whereas today, you know, it's really fucking segmented and controlled and like down to the second when things work.
I mean, today, on the other hand, it's talk, 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 talk. We should throw in a 5-minute match about here. Talk, 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 talk. We should probably do another wrestling match. Talk to talk to talk to talk. Oh, hey, we need to do the main event now.
It's over. Thanks for your money.
There's a reason I'm an Impact Wrestling fan. I'm just saying.
Anyway, so yeah, by the late 80s, the WWF is at seeing new heights. They're unstoppable. They're all pumped up on steroids. No one can stop them. No one is coming for them. And then Ted Turner buys Jim Crockett Promotions in 1988, which is pretty much the entire southern bit of America and most of the rural areas.
Yep.
So through the Turner Broadcasting System's various channels, which included a crap ton of like country channels, they started showing what became known as World Championship Wrestling, WCW. And because Turner Broadcasting Systems was a better media conglomerate, like they were better at making media at that time than the WWF was, which was still just coming out of being a regional wrestling promotion. It had eaten most of its competition by then.
Yeah.
It had subsumed the vast majority of them, but it was still being run like a typical like pro wrestling promotion. The main shows, the live shows, the shows where butts in seats are what made you money. And you couldn't rely on any goddamn television network holding you for any amount of time. Usually Vince would have to go region to region selling like station to station. And so like, oh yeah, if you're in like Northern Alabama, there's a station that'll show you like Saturday Night Wrestling or what have, but for 500 miles around, you're fucked. Whereas Turner Broadcasting Systems had the networks, they had the conglomeracy already, so they just pushed WCW out there, and immediately at their ascendancy, a contender appears, and Vince is scared fucking shitless because Turner has more money than Vince does. And while Turner's new to this, he doesn't need to play by the old rules the same way Vince decided not to play by the old rules. And so now is two titans of ego just fucking slamming into each other. And while this is early on, it certainly very soon starts to go Turner's way. And for a while there, it looked like the WWF was going to be fucking crushed. So when you watch this movie, you have to understand that it is made out of fear.
Oh, yeah. And that is the only way that the main villain, being the head of a TV network.
Yeah.
And not a rival promotion, makes any kind of sense.
Yeah. When you realize it's supposed to be Ted Turner and he's just trying to say as many horrible things he can think about Ted Turner without being super specific enough to get sued by this billionaire, suddenly everything falls into place. It's far more modern a film than 1989 suggests it should be. Like, it's a very simplistic plot, but because it's a TV promoter instead of a local promoter, like a territorial promoter going show to show and getting into fights and firing guns, watch Tales from the Territories. Jesus Christ. it comes off oddly timeless, like, but also bland, as you were saying, bland.
Yeah.
But that is necessary to know. The character, the evil villain character, damn it, what's his name?
Brell, played by Kurt Fuller.
That's
who I'm pretty sure is the only actor in this production who actually understands what kind of movie he's in.
Yes, absolutely. And that's a testament to Fuller, because he always does that. He's very good at knowing exactly what kind of a doofus to play. And you don't hire that man unless, under everything, no matter how villainous his character is, he's still a doofus. And Brell's a fucking doofus. Like, he's an asshole. He's a misogynist. He's violent. He commits multiple crimes in this in the name of trying to crush a smaller promoter.
He's playing Vince McMahon.
Yeah, well, now we're going to get into that. We're going to get into that.
Oh.
We haven't reached that on the timeline, but yeah. Yeah, he is. and two other people as well, but we'll get into that. Anyway, this film, as you say, this was an attempt to just like, all right, let's steal some thunder, let's get some more attention on us instead of our enemies, our competitors. And hey, Hogan wants to be in movies. He keeps threatening to leave. The Golden Calf wants to go away and go to Hollywood.
Yeah.
So fine. Vince says, all right, Terry, shut the fuck up. Here's $1 million for yourself. Here's $1 million. Do a movie. Here is upwards of $20 million for the production. Terry says, eight. Terry lies. Vince will find out by the end of this that Terry lies. but upwards of $20 million to produce this. And it seemed to have a pretty straightforward production. Hogan apparently at this time wasn't exactly the greatest actor, because he didn't understand that, unlike professional wrestling, you're pretending this stuff. So when he shoves a check down Brell's throat near the beginning of the movie, he actually shoved that check down Fuller's throat and nearly choked him out. Not a good start.
No.
Tiny Lister is in this as our villain, Zeus. This is where he get his Zeus character from. And...
No, hold on. You're going to introduce that man. You're going to say his name properly.
Zeus.
Well done. Well done. I really like that they literally came up with the character in here. Decided, yeah, that's good enough. That's good enough.
Yeah.
And immediately brought that character into real life for their actual promotions. There was a no-holds-barred event where the Hogan-Zeus fight actually occurred. And then, years later in the WCW after Hogan bailed, they redid it. They called him like Dr. Z or Mr. Z or something. But yeah, it's like, that's amazing that this film actually resulted in years worth of potential content and the reoccurring assertion that Tiny Lister indeed is a pro wrestler because technically he pro wrestled.
Now, first and foremost, heavy emphasis on technically, because he only had 3 matches in the WWF. Yeah.
How many did David Arquette have? Wait, no, better question. How many did David Arquette have while he was reigning world champion?
I honestly don't know. But while we're on this subject, and I'm sure we'll get into this more at some point in the future when I finally cave and we're ready to rumble.
Yes.
I every time that the Arquette title reign comes up, I do need to note this one extremely important detail, which is that the single person in the company who was the most against this idea was David Arquette.
Oh yeah, no, I'm not throwing that at David Arquette. I'm throwing that at Vince Russo and Eric Bischoff.
Oh yeah. Oh no, no. I know you. It's just that almost every time that gets mentioned, people hate on Arquette for it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah. No, he was almost literally blackmailed into accepting the world title.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's what you get for trusting people from.
Because if I remember right, he did in one of his interviews with Chris Van Vliet, the way Arquette himself tells it, like, he was this like massive wrestling fan, was having the time of his life doing this work promoting with WCW, and then eventually the time came that they came and told him they wanted to put the world title on him, and Arquette rightfully said, no, this is not a good idea. The fans are going to hate this. Everybody's going to turn on me. Like, he just literally just was going down a list of all the reasons they should not do this.
Yeah.
The company told him, if you don't do this, all the time with the boys, all the traveling with the wrestlers, everything that you are living out right now, everything that is a wrestling fan's dream, stops immediately.
He really, like, I understand not wanting to abandon that, but he definitely should have just been like, oh, wait, I'm already a famous actor. I don't need you. And I'm not going to let you despoil yourself.
I mean, on the surface, you're right. But at the same time, I do also tend to go, well, if you're a wrestling fan living that life, would you want it to end?
Certainly not, but I would definitely not want to be like some fake king of wrestling either. And that's what they attempted to make him. And it's I wish he had said no. But that's years in the future. Ooh, it's actually it's closer to when this movie came out than we are to it. Fuck, we're old.
So
yeah, this is a really super straightforward plot where an already established superstar wrestler at the WWF is enticed with money to leave the WWF and go work for this new promotion that had just been purchased by this, the if I recall, TWN, not TNN, not TBS, TWN. Don't you dare think that this is suable, Turner. Can't sue me for it.
But no. Remember, at this point in the plot, there's no promotion. They're trying to get him to come over to their network.
Oh, I know, and that's the thing. They're it's very straightforward, but they essentially build a promotion. A promotion with the dumbest name ever, by the way.
Well, yeah. Okay, before we go into that, I do want to know one quick thing is, now, like I said earlier, Kurt Fuller is the only person in this film who knows what this movie is actually supposed to be.
Yes.
Hogan thinks he's doing wrestling's equivalent of Rocky III.
Mm-hmm. He absolutely is. This is Hogan at his most Hogan, and he's trying.
To be perfectly frank, as I watched this, I kept thinking, this is not the equivalent of Rocky III. This is the equivalent of Rocky III mixed with, based on its cheesy, comedic nature, the almost amateurishness of many of these scenes. It's Rocky III mixed with UHF.
Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, definitely an inspiring story about an underdog. But instead, it's a ridiculous over-the-top wrestler. I'm gonna say it right off the top. They chose the wrong wrestler for this. I know it's not a choice. It's Hogan. It's Terry. You get stuck with him. You have to deal with him because he's a bully. This would have been amazing with the Warrior. Just like him at his brother's bedside. His brother's played by the same actor, dressed the same way, but Warrior's there in full makeup and like with no like just his trunks on. It just get better.
I would like to see that. I say see that movie, but I know for a fact that version of the movie would never get finished.
No, it would not.
I would like to see the behind-the-scenes documentary of that movie where the Warrior is changing scripts. Like, he's changing the script with every cut, and every time the director yells cut, he's demanding more money.
Oh, my God.
He hasn't even bothered to remember the script. He's just rewriting everything on the fly.
Yeah. Just... fucking nonsense.
That plot would have changed 75 times by day 2 of filming.
That is from the alternate reality where Vince McMahon Jr. dies from a heart attack 3 weeks into that production. It's called me! This film is tailor-made for Hogan because it's doing nothing but pushing his character, the 80s version of his characters, you know, like stay in school, don't do drugs, take your vitamins, you know, all that fucking nonsense that Terry didn't do himself. as he says, well, not as
know,
he does.
You know what? I would suggest that this is actually doing worse than pushing his character, because when the movie starts, for the life of me, I couldn't figure out why he wasn't in this as Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, that definitely is surprising until...
But you have the Hulk Hogan character, who is this super prominent, larger than life babyface.
Yeah.
But his character here, Rip, is what's referred to as a white meat babyface. The most just angelic, goody-goody, absolute perfect, no fault in his character. You could have transplanted Rip into an episode of that Michael Landon, that Care Bears, yes. Stairway to Heaven. That Michael Landon show.
Oof! Ouch! Yeah.
Whose name I blanked on for the joke.
No, that is. Yeah. No, that is. That's a harsh but true fact.
And it would work. And you know what wrestling fans hate more than anything? A white meat baby face.
Yeah, no, it's too much. It's too far. When Hulk at one point in this goes, or Rip at one point goes, did they tell you about my charity work? It's my most important thing. It's like, wow, damn, Terry, that's the most I've ever seen you act. Hold on here. You're not John Cena.
Highway Patrol, this is John Triton. You have officers down, multiple assailants. They have a hostage. It's my wife.
Meanwhile, on the opposite side, in the other corner of the ring, is Zeus, who is an ex-con murderer who just literally busts into the movie at the appropriate time while they are scouting for pro wrestlers at a dive bar.
Yep.
Again, this movie is full kayfabe. So in this movie, pro wrestlers are guys who fight guys using like grapples and throws and shit. And thus they can be found in bars. They can be found in steel factories. They can be found anywhere that Reaganomics tells you tough, yep, hetero straight men are found. Oh, you want the gay bar? You're looking for the gay bar. The gay bar is across the street. You want the gay bar.
Steel mill from The Simpsons, I'm just saying.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's like, it's funny how oddly, like, this film's, you know, it's 80s homophobic, but it's, like, not aggressive about it. It's weirdly playful about it. And there's even a moment where one of the professional wrestlers, like, grabs two executives while they have their dicks out, looks at both of them, and comments on their size. And it's just, yep, like, and then, like, laughs. It's like, no, I get it. You're making fun of the, you know, their tiny, tiny dicks. But, like, also, dude, why are you staring at each for, like, a good 5 seconds? What the the 80s were different. The 80s were different.
Yeah, yeah. This was the 80s where you apparently judged someone's manhood by the size of their penis compared to their wardrobe, how much makeup they wore on their face, how big their hair was.
This is a time when a man named Macho could come out to pomp and circumstance wearing fucking highlighter pink. Oh yeah!
I 80s glam rock, again, just saying.
And yet, there's none of that in this. None of that. There's none of the excitement, none of the craziness. Jesse Ventura is in it for a hot second, and he's the most wild and out there thing. Gene even insults his hair. Cool. Like,
yeah, I'm now, as long as we're talking makeup, I would like to point out that Bill Eady, one, depending on the time period, one half or one third of Demolition.
Yeah.
Is in this movie.
Yes.
Makeup? Fuck no.
No, no. And it, which is a shame because, you know.
Absolutely.
Fucking Demolition. Yeah. Yeah. But, which is, Demolition had a lot of movie roles. It's bizarre. There was a strange affinity that everyone, including myself, had for them. Truly the greatest. Truly. but, yeah, like, there's no one on display in this who is big enough or weird enough for it. Like, I could understand if they had Andre throw down for a minute, a hot, yeah, minute. Although at this point, Andre had a legitimate film career and didn't need your bullshit. Thank you very much.
God bless you, Rob Reiner.
Yeah. And, you know, again, I know that they didn't necessarily want to push too hard. But why is the villain in this not like the Warrior or fucking Randy Savage or Jake the Snake? Like, I understand you want someone who is large physically for it.
Yeah.
But you had, like, the entire point of the kind of wrestling Vince McMahon focused on, refined, and brought to the forefront was cartoonish shit. Like, this is, I think, 3 years before The Undertaker appears, but could you imagine if The Taker was introduced in this? Like, it would only have added to it, and it would have worked so much better to have something just a little more for our squeaky clean baby face to have to fight.
Yeah, Suburban Commando was 1991, so literally, I think he debuted like that year ish.
SummerSlam, 91 or 92. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. tiny little angry Southern man.
But like Zeus as a villain was a good idea. There's no point in the movie where they try to connect him and Rip in any way.
Yeah. It's like, again, it's a very kayfabe 80s pro wrestling angle of I hate you, and then they just keep doing bad shit to each other. There's no motivation. There's simply fight.
It's the standard. The villain challenges the hero to a fight, but the hero is scared and doesn't want to fight him because he's not sure if he can take him. Yada. You know the plot that we've by this point seen in Rocky 3 times.
Yeah. Yeah. And to be fair, yes, Brell does set this whole thing in motion by jumpstarting a promotion by offering $100,000 is $100,000 bounty Rip's head. Essentially say, "Listen, if you know, come on down, kick his fucking ass and I'll give you a pile of money. Just kick this man's ass. I'm obsessed needlessly with this man." Even though my executives and creative team keep pitching completely different shows, which should indicate to me that our market is not pro wrestling, nor has it ever been.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said, it's the standard. Rip is scared to face him. Why?
That's another reason why I think we don't get Hogan, like Hogan, the character in here, because Hogan wouldn't be afraid. And so that, like, it's like the Rock's ego, you know, I'm not going to fight, the little boy in the man's body that demeans my character. And by my character, I mean Dwayne the Rock Johnson.
Yeah.
WWE Hall of Famer, which is always the first thing that matters, seemingly. And I wonder if Hulk was like, "Oh, okay, so I'm going to be playing a different version of this character, not the one that makes me money, because I don't want you to think that the Hulkster is afraid of anything."
But like, the thing is, though, they apparently decide that the I'm scared to confront this guy because the story requires me to be scared to confront this guy is not enough, which it's not. So they eventually have Rip's brother, who is basically in the movie just for this moment, and played by Mark Pellegrino in a role that I am convinced is the other half of a deal with the devil that got him onto Supernatural.
Yeah. Yeah. I've actually read that where it's like, he must've just been a dream to work with because how the fuck?
Yeah. But he decides to go to Zeus's gym to confront Zeus for the sole purpose of getting beaten up, put into the hospital, and then shows up at the final fight in a wheelchair to the point that you expect a Sean Astin cameo as Rudy. Like, my God, the cliches.
Yeah, there are, this is a film of cliches, which again, kayfabe wrestling, very straightforward, nothing but cliches. But yeah, like we get our basic plot elements. We get, of course, he gets beaten the shit up so that we can have our character development and drive. There is a weird romance that develops needlessly between the Sam, the ad executive or marketing executive or whatever at not Turner and Hulk. It's really weird and fucked up. And then not Turner assaults her and it just turns super weird and dark.
And to give you an idea of how messed up this is.
Yeah.
They meet in a business meeting where Rip is supposed to see her and be immediately infatuated with her.
Is that what that is?
Oh.
I thought he was dismissive and stared at her ass.
Apparently, Hogan's idea of infatuation is to look like he is instantly so horny at the sight of her that he is trying to hide his 24-inch python under the desk.
Yeah, no, that seems to track for his actual personality in real life. Except for the python. He is on court record admitting he has a tiny dick. Actually, I believe the phrasing he used from this movie is he's part of the teeny weeny peeny club. Anyway. 24-inch python is Hogan's dick. Hogan is a character he plays. That's an actual legal defense. That's in the record.
That is far more believable than it actually should be.
Right. Anyway. This film ends, well, as we said, Hogan craps out an ending, quite literally. We get a basic wrestling match, a basic Hogan wrestling match, and Brell electrocutes himself to death out of nowhere, kind of. This is a film that immediately would have the cops called on it. Like, it fades to black as Hogan holds his thumb up, but immediately after, police would arrive. They would find out that this head of this like fucking media corporation had committed multiple felony acts in a conspiracy to buy a pro wrestler for some fucking reason. And then had accidentally killed himself in an industrial accident, which is like, what the fuck is happening here? Involving an ex-con who I'm pretty sure, considering the fact that he assaulted a guy who is also present there, is going back to fucking jail. Like,
if he's lucky.
There is so much more to this film. Instead, it just gives us an 80s, everything worked out. And yep. It ends. It ends. It's over. And and it did shit. Technically, it was the second highest box office for 2 weeks behind Ghostbusters 2. No, wait, my mistake. It was the second highest box office for 2 weeks behind, if I recall, The Last Crusade. So Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, which is impressive until you realize that Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade was pretty much released to its own so that no one would fuck with it. You know, Indy made a ton of money, and this did not.
No, but and this is maybe the only time I will ever have the opportunity to use this segue. Speaking of crapping things out and shit, we have glossed over what may have been one of the most important terrible line exchanges in cinematic history.
Oh, there's so many to choose from. How could you pick?
Now, that's easy because you referenced Hogan shoving a check down Kurt Fuller's throat earlier.
Indeed.
And then Rip leaves this meeting, climbs into a limo that apparently Brell rented from the same company as every 80s Bond villain. because all of a sudden, it's the standard they drive out and Rip's looking around and he's yelling at the driver like, you're going the wrong way. You should have taken this turn yet. Yeah, you know that the spontaneous kidnapping is about to happen.
Oh yeah, totally spontaneous, not a conspiracy.
No. Like, it's not as if he happened to climb into a limousine where steel panels can slide up over the windows on a moment's notice. Oh, wait, that's exactly what happened. The limo's driving down the street. Apparently, Hulk Hogan's kicks to the limo doors are so powerful that he can cause the car to swerve, put dents in the outside of the door, but nothing happens to the paneling on the inside. 80s cinema. We end up in a warehouse where we have a scene of Rip taking on six or seven random goons, where Hulk Hogan apparently thinks fight acting is spending the entire time looking like a Neanderthal having a seizure.
I mean, that's most of his in-ring work, too.
Oh, yeah. That's the thing. That is the problem with his acting in a nutshell. You're in front of a camera, not in the middle of a ring. You do not need to be doing expressions that can be seen by 9-year-old me up in the nosebleeds, where the only thing behind him is brick wall.
Yeah. Yeah.
But after Rip finally gets back to the driver, and then one of the most beautifully famous bad lines 80s cinema has ever produced, where Rip goes, "What's that smell?"
What's that smell?
Dookie.
Dookie.
So stupid. So beautiful, beautiful stupid.
And yeah, that's the outcome of a Braille plan. And as you've alluded to before, Burrell is very much who Vince McMahon, or rather Mr. McMahon, would become.
Oh.
Mr. McMahon,
oh, yeah,
being a caricature in many ways of Vince McMahon that would play into a massive part in the Attitude Era and the ascendancy, the final ascendancy of the WWF, then later WWE, to fucking like king of wrestling over the world and ruling with a despotic fist. Yes. But he, like, he's this character Braille. It's funny that you know, I assume that Vince was working on this character for years and years in the back of his head. He always wanted to be a wrestler. He always kind of kept in shape.
Oh yeah.
And his father wouldn't allow him. So you kind of get the idea that Braille was this character that, you know, like, yes, he's driven by Ted Turner quite a bit, obviously, but it's the little things, the little petty vengeances, the petty angers, the petty crimes that will later become a staple of the character of Mr. McMahon and evident in the soul of Vince Jr. But what also really fascinated me about this is not only do you see the beginnings of the Mr. McMahon character, you also see like a prophecy of Vince Russo and Eric Bischoff, where it's like,
yeah,
someone is going to swoop in with one of these companies and a fuck ton of cash, and they are going to try to steal everything from you. And that it was Hogan starring in this, of all things. And then 5 years later, it was Hogan who was like, yes, I think I shall take that,
yep,
money from you, billionaire. I don't remember that movie because it sucked. Yes. And then he bailed. And then he took a bunch of people with him. Not intentionally. Only, I think, Lex wanted to go with Hogan. Hogan's an asshole. But eventually, others followed. And when you lost Diesel and Razor and tried to replace them, oh no. Oh,
ooh,
no. You know, you saw,
yeah,
the true beginnings of the Monday Night War. this film is the opening shot of the Monday Night War, but the bullet goes into orbit and it spins around for about 6 years before it finally comes down and hits Vince McMahon in the back of the head. He somehow survived, but he came out a different man.
Oh, yeah. Like, this movie is so prophetic that if you watched the WWF during the Attitude Era, you'll know exactly where I'm going with this when I say Brell even has his own Patterson and Briscoe.
Yeah. Yeah. The entire thing is just, it's just Brell. And that the WWF, WWE, whatever, owns this character approach, all of it outright, means that they can just lift. You know, same thing with Zeus. Take it. Just lift it out. And I love how Fuller even has speech patterns that, like, I don't know, maybe he was talking to Vince McMahon at some point and was like, uh-huh, okay, cool. I'm gonna use some of your, what you're doing here, I'm gonna do it. Because even if it's subconscious, my villain character is obviously you. And so there's things in the way he foams. Just, Vince.
Watching it, I didn't get even the slightest shred of a sense of Ted Turner here.
Like Ted Turner because of context, you know?
Yeah,
like, knowing, literally knowing, because otherwise, the character.
Oh, that character screams Vince.
Yeah, that is Mr. McMahon to a goddamn T. And so much so that a funny thought popped into my head. And it's that I think the WWE should remake this movie every time they're definitively in a different era. So this was the 80s version. There should be like an early 90s colorful, super fucking colorful spectacle version. There should be an Attitude Era version where obviously, you know, it's Stone Cold instead, and they're fighting directly against WCW, and it's Vince in the character. Then there should be like a John Cena era version, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. This is a film that is so straightforward, but so adaptable, and they own literally all the fucking rights to it. They even, the music's by their in-house guy.
Yeah.
God damn it, Vince, you're so fucking cheap.
And it's fascinating. Like, the actual score in the movie is so generic.
Mm-hmm.
And yet Jim Johnston's No Holds Barred, like the actual song, the theme. I mean, it's not Eye of the Tiger.
No.
But
it's adjacent.
I would put it somewhere around, no, I don't want to say You've Got the Touch. Ooh, maybe somewhere in the general vicinity of You're the Best Around from The Karate Kid.
Okay, yeah, a song that, you know, it's not really hype up, it's kind of annoying, you don't want to hear it too much, but you get the idea of it. God, I hate Best Around. More so because it's one of the songs that, like, when I'm bored and my brain is just processing something else, it'll start doing it, and it's just, no.
Yeah.
Stop.
Oh, yeah, it's... Like the actual No Holds Barred theme, I went into this movie, I was expecting, like, a little kind of opening action segment of something. Like, the bit at the actual WWF show,
and then
you would have like Rip riding his motorcycle along the highway or something, where you get the opening titles, and you would think the No Holds Barred theme would come in there.
That would make sense.
How the fuck does this song not get used until the end credits?
Right, it's a song that I'm surprised they didn't use five times, like obnoxiously in that 80s sense of wringing every, you know, dollar value out of every note. I don't know. I don't know. I think they wanted to make a splash. This movie didn't exactly have much directorial vision in the sense of like doing anything crazy. It really is just an extended Jumbotron back screen element. Like, you know, you could cut this expertly with actual like live matches that have nothing to do with it, and it would make sense.
Oh, no, it totally would, because to be perfectly honest, in terms of the cinematography, if you were to tell me that they used actual WWF camera crews to film this,
yeah,
I would not be surprised in the least.
Yeah, at the very least, I suspect that if it wasn't their own camera crews working this, Vince took a copy of this, threw this at his video team, and went, like that!
Yeah. Oh yeah, no doubt. And there are so many just strange moments where you'd swear something happens just because of Hogan's ego.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it probably did. Like, that's the thing. You don't even have to say what thing it is. It's just, yeah, no, that's Hogan. It doesn't matter like, who it is.
I'm thinking specifically of the bit between Sam and Rip in the hotel, where their booking has been conveniently changed so that now that they have a room with only one bed.
So bad.
Oh yeah, it's so terrible. Hogan puts tape across the room so that he can hang up a blanket to divide the single bed in half.
Mm-hmm.
Again, white meat baby face.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But at one point, Sam goes to sleep, wakes up to the bed bouncing incessantly. Like, you'd swear it's supposed to be a masturbation joke of some sort?
Like, yeah, you kind of get the feeling that that's what it is. He's really going into it. It's complicated because it would technically make better sense if he was having sex with someone, but obviously it's meant to be a masturbation joke. But it's like, what, like, and she looks over and he's doing like push ups, but it's like, those are really fucking fast push ups based on the sound. There's,
yeah,
it's half considered. And yeah, I suspect you're right. It's definitely him being like, hey, you would be funny.
Well, yeah, like, it's also how the scene itself does not need Hogan to say anything.
No.
But he tosses out a random, like, don't wait up for me or something like that. Like, it's just, it feels like a line just to give Hogan a line, number one. Number two, I'd almost swear that he is more oiled and tanned with each cut. And the boxers that he's wearing, I'd almost swear, become Speedos and then a thong.
Yeah.
With each cut?
Pretty much. Yeah, by the time the bed flips and she lands on top of him, he's definitely staining just all of the blankets.
Yeah, exactly.
This film is weird. It's not, like, it's entertaining to watch if you are a wrestling fan, if you have the context of knowing, you know, the business, the history, these characters, these people, what they got up to. It has a value and an entertainment to be watched. If, however, you know, you are an average audience member, this is not good. This is a very dry, boring and tedious film in which the most obvious story of, like, from the 80s, like, to the point that here's a challenge: take a bad 80s film and just splice in bits of the A team and just have it seem like it's an A plot and a B plot. You don't even need to do A team.
Yeah.
Here's the Incredible Hulk, you know, like, and just have it bounce in and out. Quantum Leap, and just cut it so that it's implied that God damn, Sam is in Hogan's body.
Oh my God, yes.
Especially when his brother gets, like, beaten. That is classic Quantum Leap. Now you have to go do the thing, and your broken family member is there to root you on. And like it flash freezes with Hogan giving the thumbs up, and then just add the effect, the leap effect right there in the movie ends.
That has no right to work, and yet...
It also explains why Hogan goes from being a dickhead to being the character in this. It's Sam. It's Sam Beckett.
Yeah, and now, also, as I said earlier, if you are going into this expecting the insanity of bad 80s film that I was, like... The cocaine fuel, what the hell is happening? You're not going to get that in the movie. But we are here to help you. Stay tuned to the end of this episode, because we are going to give you about 3-4 minutes of just pure, unadulterated, China white cocaine of 80s wrestling. What the fuck? Because, as we've mentioned, Zeus was brought out of this movie into the actual 80s WWF to feud with Hogan.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, he was to be part of a no-holds-barred steel cage tag match where it was Hogan and the guy that he goes to if he needs a partner in anything business related, Brutus the Barber Beefcake,
who definitely should have played his younger brother in this and gotten his shit rocked just like he did every day in the ring.
Absolutely. And on the other side was Randy Macho Man Savage and Zeus.
Oh yeah.
Now This promo is what is referred to often as the "you don't know" promo, and when you hear it, you will understand, because this is Zeus, Randy Savage, and Sensational Sherry all losing their goddamn minds.
Delightful. I have seen it many times before. I cannot wait to hear it again.
This needs to be heard. This needs to be witnessed. This is 80s wrestling perfection.
Oh my god. Sorry, I just immediately saw the witness me scene from Fury Road, but they're all dressed kind of like Macho Man. Just a chorus of "ooh yeah, ooh yeah, ooh yeah, ooh yeah." Explosion. The cream has risen to the top.
Okay, internet, if y'all can drop Macho Man dialogue into video games, I think you know what you need to do. I need the Fury Road Macho cut.
It'd be a beautiful thing. I feel like once we start making up better movies, we've reached the end of this one. Is there anything else you want to say about this abomination?
Not really. Beyond the simple fact that Joan Severance, who played Sam... I am so sorry that you had to do this, because on my end, the only thing she gets out of it is the fact that it made me go to her IMDb bio and discover the Black Scorpion movies.
And they're special. Oh, yeah.
That now I kind of want to track down and watch.
That's Roger Corman, right?
I think so. It sounds very Roger Corman anyway.
If I recall, Space the Imagination Station played a whole fucking block of them once. It was the Black Scorpion Fest. It was like, oh my Jesus Christ. This is the worst fucking shit. I love it.
No, it's, I don't, it doesn't look like it's actually Roger Corman. There's no mention of him.
Curious.
However, again, I love weird IMDb plot summaries. For the first Black Scorpion movie, a female Batman with a strong story, intriguing characters, good action pacing, and several opportunities for sex.
Mm-hmm.
That is what they wrote down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. That, yes. That is those movies. That's all of those movies.
Like, I want to go watch those now.
Yeah, like, by all means, you're going to have a great time because they are so stupid, but embracing themselves.
Yeah.
Like, you ever see that Goosebumps episode, the classic Goosebumps episode where they meet the mutant? Like,
No, I can tell you right now, no, because I never actually watched Goosebumps.
Gah! Anyway, it's just so over the top and so, like, it's a comic book character who looks more like a pro wrestler kind of thing. It's if and I know that no pro wrestling association would ever do this. No promotion would stoop this low. It's like if a wrestler got dressed up like a superhero in a cheap fucking costume and then jumped about pretending they had superpowers. I've never seen that in the ring, thankfully.
No, I thought that you were going to mention having a wrestler dress up as a zombie on your debut episode of the Sci-Fi Channel, or have a bunch of zombies surround the ring as lumberjacks on a pay-per-view for no reason beyond promoting a Dave Bautista movie. Oh, wait, hold on. No, never mind.
No, wait, I've got it. Yeti Mummy.
No, again, if you're going to say it, you're going to say it right. The Yeti.
Oh. Because he's not Yeti, because he's a fucking mummy.
And the only thing that I feel like needs to be noted is for all Brell's scheming, for all Kurt Fuller's beautifully cartoonish acting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I would submit that Brell's downfall was actually not getting electrocuted. That was the aftermath of his downfall. You know what his downfall actually was?
Hubris?
He asked Hulk Hogan to do a job.
Shouldn't have done that.
You never ask Hulk Hogan to do a job.
Yeah, this is the number one mistake, and it's kind of fitting.
Exactly.
Vince later found out that you never ask Hulk Hogan to do a job. Specifically, Hulk said that if this movie was not a success, he would give his $1 million paycheck back. And in the depths of the Monday Night Wars, McMahon on national television said that I guess the check is still in the mail. Hulk never gave that money back.
Of course
the
not.
The movie fucking sucked. But if you want to give us $1 million in cashier's check, please, you can send it along.
Or if a cashier's check isn't viable for whatever reason, remember Crash does have a Patreon. But if you want to email us and thank us for watching this movie so that you don't ever have to.
You really don't
have remember, to. Remember, with my reputation, I'm the one who's saying, yeah, you don't have to watch this.
You really don't have to watch this.
We can be reached via email at realgeekshfx@gmail.com or realgeekshfx on Twitter. I can be reached as the Maritime Lord on Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, Hive, and now possibly Clapper, which is basically a low rent version of TikTok that I feel like from the name alone is inviting all kinds of jokes.
Yes, that the content there is going to be fantastic. I can tell already. And I can be found on Twitter at Friday in Halifax and Crash and Burn everywhere else. I almost went into the Ray to Rubble voice, but that's the wrong company. Wrong promotion. Wrong promotion.
As for our next episode, now, the thing that I love here is that you've already mentioned what our next movie is going to be.
Oh, no.
Because we will be continuing our deep dive into my pop culture childhood, I guess, with a film from 2011, of all things.
You were a child in 2011?
I know, it sounds weird, but go with me on this for a second, because...
All right, then.
We will be watching the cinematic remake of the TV, one of the TV series that I was obsessed with growing up, which is, of course, The A-Team.
They fly tanks now? They fly tanks now! They fly tanks now.
Or at least such is the plan. And I love it when a plan comes together.
Oh my god, you're actually chewing on a carrot.
It's a pepperoni stick, but I mean, it's a podcast and nothing screams good comedy like prop jokes.
I'm just offended it's not a Slim Jim.
I gotta be honest, I am offended that I didn't think of that.
Next snap, in my estimation, no one individual has ever tested the primeval instincts of Hulk Hogan like this man Zeus. Imagine one of the individuals being thrown so hard that the momentum carries him not only into the ropes but beyond to the potential devastation of the 15-foot-high steel cage. It's a no-holds-barred match with no-holds-barred rules. Right now, let's get comments from the Macho King, Randy Savage, and the human wrecking machine, Zeus.
Yeah, this is Wednesday. Zeus the Barber, Beefcake, and Hulk Hogan, y'all come to our house. High steel cage, all the way around. There are no rules in a steel cage. No rules, but... He has no control. And when you get him with rules and regulations, he's like a fish out of water. But in our house, you pukamaniacs are gonna finally see something that you wish you never saw, but you did. And there's nothing that you can do about it, cause Hulk Hogan. Yeah, he is. And Queen Sensational Jerry, where are you gonna be?
You don't know.
Oh,
you don't know where I'm gonna be, Hulk Hogan.
No.
You don't know where I'm going to be.
Hulk Hogan! Anywhere. Anywhere, Zeus. Hulk Hogan! Machine, yeah! This is my home! Mr. No Referee! I am going to destroy you! Oh, you pukamaniacs! This Wednesday! It happens, yeah. Doesn't it happen?
You don't know where I'm going to be, Hogan!
No!
see what you've been through, and it's all because of me. Brother, you know you made me proud. You gave me something to believe. But it's my turn now. I won't let you down. Gonna make things right. We'll turn it all around. Love goes far. But it's no more. No!